Today's page is, today's picture is on page 80 from the Blue Rock Collection. Joe Shoots a Newborn Baby. Main subject, a monk asked Joe Shoots, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Joshu said, it's like throwing a ball into the rapids. The monk later asked Tosu, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said, nen after nen without ceasing. Secha's verse, the question, the six senses, purposeless. Well acquainted with it, the masters. The ball is thrown into the rapids. Do you know where it is carried? Yesterday evening in Dokusan, somebody came in to see me, and the person was obviously having a lot of pain, a lot of trouble with pain, and basically had been moving around quite a bit on the cushion. And strangely, this person was talking about many things, but didn't talk about his pain. And was saying, it was a great sit, and was trying some new techniques, and so on and so on. And I said, well, you know, those techniques, I haven't heard of them, but, you know, what about your pain? And the person became a little more somber. Said, you know, there's a million techniques in the world for doing all kinds of things. You know, we can sit on the cushion and visualize light, or we could form an image of Guan Yin or the Virgin Mary in our minds and focus on it all day. Or, you know, we could try to levitate things. You know, we could put something in front of us and try to levitate something, make it float through the air. There's all kinds of ways the mind can be structured and disciplined and trained. But it seems to me that one valuable aspect of pain is that it really cuts through all the bullshit. Maybe you've had this experience, but when I was just getting started in Zen practice, I would sit on the cushion and I would try to visualize a wonderful place. So I might be in pain on the cushion and I would visualize someplace like the Appalachian Mountains where I like to walk. And I would try to transport myself to that other place. But it was no good, you know, the pain really, really brought me right back to the cushion. No matter what I could do. And I have to tell you the truth that in the early stages of my Zen practice, I would be in a lot of pain and I would actually pray. You know, I would actually say, you know, whoever you are out there, if you just take my pain away, you know, I'll be a better person. I'll do whatever you want, as a matter of fact. You know, and it didn't work, you know, and I would try to command my pain away. I thought, maybe it's just willpower, you know, just say, you know, be gone, you know, and there it was, it just eating me up, you know, And at the time, I thought this was very unfortunate. But and now I see it was a wonderful thing because, you know, it really cuts through illusion, doesn't it? You know, it cuts through illusion. It forces us out of our dreams. It forces us out of our fantasies. It forces us out of, you know, it even forces us out of culture itself, you know, which is very hard to do. You know, all through our lives we're socialized and enculturated, as they say. And we're given all of these messages and all of this stuff. And, you know, on the cushion, you know, it just cuts through all of it. The pain just cuts through all of it. You know, I've told this story before, but Genki Roshi, a person came to a sesshin that Genki Roshi was leading. And this person was a rather famous philosopher. And left the sesshin about halfway through and said, if I stay here another minute, it will destroy my philosophy. And I think that's really revealing. You know, it's like you can have all kinds of set ideas about life, and you can have a formula that you use to crank through all your experiences. You know, whatever happens, you, yes, you know, that's the oneness of the many and the manyness of the one, you know. So if you hear a bird singing in the bushes, you can say, the many and the one and the many. You know, you can have some system. Boy, when you sit on the cushion and you're in pain, all of those systems are blown right out the window. And this person was sort of, my impression was that this person was doing what I used to do a lot, which was run from pain. You know, I also think that, you know, what I used to do was to try to cover it up, you know. So I'd have a lot of pain, but I wouldn't come into the teacher and say, you know, I'm having a lot of pain. I'd come into the teacher and say, all is one. You know? And I'd have some formula about Zen, you know, the moment is all, you know, now. And I was moving around on the cushion like crazy. You know. And I'm sure Genki Roshi saw it, and I just couldn't bring myself to believe that I was in pain. We have all of these ideas about how things are, who we are, and it's very humbling just to sit there and be in pain. You don't have to be in pain forever, but it's a kind of necessary stage, and it's very very good thing. It brings us right back down to earth. It shows us the limits of our ideas. It shows us the limits of all those schemes and all those concepts that we've been socialized into. And I just think that's wonderful. So anyway, this person came in to see me and was doing something which is not normal meditation practice and having some kind of an experience which is not really what we're aiming at in Zen practice. And then I said, so anyway, what's happening with your pain? And the person looked very crestfallen. And I said, you know, really you have to deal with your pain. Somehow you've got to deal with it. You've got to confront it. And I said, if you keep moving, you know, you can keep moving forever. But you've got to face it. It's the door you have to go through. And then I was really frank about it. I said, you know, when we sit on the cushion and we cross our legs and straighten our back, at some point our knees become tired and we have a pain sensation that grows and grows. And at some point we actually enter a kind of state which is a lot like the state of shock. You know, actually, it's like a controlled shock. So, you know, I'm sure you've seen you've read stories about people who have been in shock, you know, where you're in a lot of pain and then suddenly you're out of your body, you know, and you feel like all the pain is gone. This is common, this is a common account that's given by people who have been, you know, hit by a car or shot. You know, I was reading an account about somebody who was shot, and the person said, you know, there was like a burning in my arm, or I guess the shoulder, and it became very intense, and then suddenly I was like floating. And that this is a very common experience. And when I was a boy, people in on the base used to, where I was growing up on the naval weapons station, used to hunt. My father was a hunter, and my brother, they were both avid hunters, and I myself never liked hunting. But I had heard stories about deer who had gotten shot, and they just run for a long time. And I think they enter a kind of shock state eventually, and they don't feel any pain. And their awareness really changes. And I said to this person, you know, we're kind of entering like a shock state. This is like controlled shock. And he said, he wasn't sure if I was making a joke or not. And I said, no, you know, this is really what we want to do. And there's a condition in which you become dissociated. It's like out-of-body experience. It's hard to achieve this out-of-body experience, but this is actually what we're aiming at. And in this state, you begin to feel sometimes like you're literally out of your body, or you may feel like your body is very empty and light. I sometimes feel like I'm just a bunch of cobwebs. Like there's somebody describing it as being like a hollow statue. But this state is very important. It's like entering a shock state. It's like out of body. In fact, it's called dropping the body in Zen practice. So people sometimes, not always, but sometimes in deep concentration, in the presence of pain, people go into have a kind of shock reaction, and they drop the body. And then you're in this place, it's very still and empty in all directions. And you're aware of your body, you're aware of sound and things like that, but these sensations seem rather distant. And when I explained this to this person, I said, this is where you have to go. The person was a little bit, he said, well, what good would this do? Why would I want to go into shock? Are you kidding? And I said, no, this is really very important. Because one way to think about Zen practice is that we're relearning from the ground up how to interact with the world. It's like we didn't get it right the first time, and now we have to go back and try it again from square one. You know, so we're sort of reconstructing ourselves from nothingness, you know, on up. And when you enter this state where you're a disembodied consciousness, this is like a square one, or ground zero, you can say. This is where we start, right? Consciousness without a pure awareness, without any kind of obstruction or any kind of embodiment. And we're hovering in this place which is empty and spacious, opening up in all directions, just pure consciousness. And Zen practice takes us back to that place, and we don't even have to die. You know, normally you have to die and come back and try again, like in Groundhog Day. Groundhog Day is like the most Buddhist movie ever made. But definitely, And it's really all about getting it wrong, getting it wrong, getting it wrong. And each time, maybe learn a little bit more. But you don't have to actually die. You can die. We say die on the cushion. That's another Zen saying. So when you sit on the cushion and you're in pain and you're in pain and you're in pain, and then something clicks, and it's like it all drops away, and you're a spider webs blowing in the wind, or you're a hollow reed, or you're a burned out stick of incense, or you're floating outward, or you're an empty statue. These are all the same sensation, different ways to describe it. You're back at ground zero, right? Stage one, just pure awareness. And you could think about Zen training as reintegrating all the things that humans do into your life again, but in a different way, right? It's like building life all over again, reacquiring a body, reacquiring a mind, reacquiring imagination, emotions, but this time different in a different way, you know? And this is literally true. This is like, I believe, literally true. It's why the physical aspect of what we do is so important. You know, and why it's necessary to enter into this disembodied state, this radically dissociated state. Because eventually, everything is reincorporated into the life we lead, but in a different way. That's the Zen project, basically, is to rebuild a human being, this time, though, not with the fear and attachment at the center, but compassion and pure awareness, yeah? Without boundaries, which is the same thing as compassion, as a matter of fact. So this is like an ambitious project for re-education and reconstructing the human being from the ground up. This is what Buddhism, one way to understand what Buddhism is all about. You know, all the time we're being educated by our life. We're being trained. So, you know, I was in the grocery store buying some groceries the other day for the sesshin, and a mother was trying to get her kids by the cookie aisle. And a kid was just, this little kid in the shopping cart was just wailing. You know, you would have thought his mother had spanked him or something. He was just, it was just like his heart was broken. And he was, you know, he obviously had his eye on some cookies, you know. And there's nothing wrong with wanting cookies, but you know, he's a little kid, he's probably already seen hundreds of commercials, you know, telling him you must have this cookie, you know. And, we're socialized, we're conditioned, and we're constructed by our society really to be like, I want, I want, I want, I want, all the time. It's like, you're at the center of this imaginary self, and if you can be made into a self that wants, 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 and it sees itself as the center, you know, you'll buy a lot of things. You might give it a, I hate to say this, you might be a good soldier, you know. You might be a hard worker, so you'll be useful to all kinds of people. And you'll be a good consumer, you know. Now, you might not be that kind and compassionate and understanding, but that's not necessarily everybody's educational objective. You know, so this is, sesshin is like a karmic hospital, yeah? But it's also like a karmic schoolhouse, right? We're relearning how to walk, how to eat, how to sleep, and we're going to do it starting from ground zero, starting all over again. We don't even have to die. And the whole Zen project, all these koans, is like, is like rebuilding the human being, only this time, not with a selfish I at the center, but with infinite compassion at the center. Yeah. And this is the same thing as emptiness extending in all directions, same thing as pure awareness. So, Sesshin is really like this wonderful opportunity. And, you know, the encounter with pain is not what we think it is. You know, it's not about being tough. It's not about an ordeal. It's just the way we become little babies again. You know? It's like becoming a baby again. You know, there's something so elemental, so primordial, about being in pain. You know, it's one of the most basic human response. It's maybe the most basic human response to the world. You know, perhaps this is why the first thing Lord Shakyamuni, the first thing the Buddha taught was the reality of suffering. You know, it's interesting, the Buddha didn't start out by teaching about techniques of ecstasy. He didn't talk about the gods. He talked about the reality of suffering. This is like the most human thing. In fact, most typical of living creatures is that they have pain. And all of culture, all of politics, all of these things are responses, are neurotic responses to pain. And what we're trying to do is have a different kind of response to pain. You know, I said this in the Dokusan, and I believe it. I think that if people run from pain, they'll run from anything, and they'll never stop running. And also, you know, if people fear pain, they'll do almost anything to get out of pain. I mean, I really think people will sell their children to get out of pain if the pain is bad enough. You know, so confronting pain is very, very important. You know, finding a way of dealing with pain that would not require you to sacrifice the people around you, and that would not require you to become cruel or violent person. This is very difficult to find this way of dealing with pain. So, you know, sitting on the cushion and being in pain is a very noble activity, and people generally confront many aspects of themselves in the process, and we try many strategies, you know, and if you're struggling with pain, let me just say I have the greatest respect for you, you know, everybody is on your side in this room. We're all in the same boat. And there's other forms of pain, of course, too, besides physical pain. And that there's emotional pain. And there's other kinds of pain, like the pain of disappointment or the pain of frustration. You know, the interesting thing about, one of the interesting things about working with koans, for example, is that no matter how many koans you answer, the next koan always takes you back to, always requires you to go back to ground zero again. See, people who haven't done very many koans think that the more koans they do, the better they're going to get at it. And so, you know, you might pass the mu koan, and then somebody gives you another koan. And you think, well, this one will be easy because the teacher's been saying, you know, that the mu is the door to the is the gate of no barrier. So after this, it'll be easy. Next koan, you're just right back where you are, sitting on a cushion, pain in your legs, frustrated, unable to answer. It's like, God damn it, I've been practicing for 10 years and I still can't answer my stupid koans. You know, but you have to go back to ground zero. You have to go back to, you know, the empty space in all directions. You have to drop the body and die on the cushion. And you have to rebuild the human being from the ground up each time, all over again. With the, it's like each koan is like adding a little something. It's one way to think about it. And so we're all rebuilding ourselves over and over again on the cushion in the image of kindness and compassion. And we know it's there because when everything else is taken away, it, you know, leaps into our hearts, right? You know, you sit on the cushion, you're in pain, you're in pain, you're in pain, and then all of a sudden everything drops away and you hear the sound of a bird or maybe even the sound of a cricket going cheep, 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 cheep for 2 hours. So beautiful, right? I hate it, I hate it, I hate it, and boom, I love it. By the way, I found that cricket. I looked for him last night, and I looked and I looked. You know, I'd look and he'd be quiet. And I sat there for a while and then he'd go cheep, cheep, cheep. And I'd try to find him, nothing. So I came in this morning and he was, there he was, cheep, cheep, cheep. And he was on the other side of the fireplace, so I just took the poker and raked the ashes a little bit, and he leapt out under the altar. So I had a lamp over there, that battery-powered lamp, and I flicked it on, and I moved the altar away. And he was so good, you know. He is so skillful. I couldn't find him. I looked under it, but he's not there. But I took the altar apart, and I took everything away, and there was this, it looked like I had squashed him. I thought, oh, I crushed him. He was just almost flat on the floor. He had flattened down under it. He was very skillful. And I picked him up, and he started bouncing around in my hand, and I took him out the door. And I'll tell you the truth, you know, last night listening to him, you would have thought he was like 2 inches. He was smaller than a dime, you know? It's amazing. I just thought, there's moo power for you, you know? A little animal making this such a huge noise. For him, it must sound deafening, you know? This huge noise. So, you know, in our ordinary selves, we listen to the sound of the cricket, and we think, this is not what I had in mind. You know, I wanted a peaceful, quiet sit. And you know, if you listen to the cricket long enough, you can get really pissed off, you know, and bitter. Now this is not, you know, I came here for a sesshin, not for this crap. And this is getting in the way of my enlightenment, and so on and so on. And these are like common reactions. This has happened to me a million times. And, you know, but if you watch your breath, you call move, eventually, you know, you die on the cushion. And then you do have this response. It doesn't really matter what you notice when you're in that state. Whatever you notice is going to be like a beautiful, beautiful, it's like the face of your mother. Sound of the voice of somebody you love, you know, just absolutely. And it might not be very poetic. There's a koan that actually asks you to identify this sound. Let me just tell you, it's not the sound of one hand clapping, just for the record. But there's a koan that asks you to identify a sound that you encounter after you've entered deep emptiness, deep nothingness. And I went in to see Webb Sensei, and I told him that, you know, he said, all right, what's your answer? And in our Zendo, we had a fan going. And it was because it was so hot in the room. And I said, it's the fan, the sound of the fan. And he looked a little disappointed because I think he wanted it to be like a beautiful bird sound or something. It was just a fan whirring. But for me, you know, that was the most beautiful sound in the world. That was like the voice of my true self in that moment. So, you know, for some people it's the sound of rain. For some people it's something, beautiful bird. For me it was just like the sound of a fan. But that doesn't really matter. It's all Buddha, okay, to the person who's deeply in the Mushin. So, you know, Zen practice has no ending, actually. There's something we call Daikensho, and that is a psychologically decisive event. But this process of going to square one or ground zero and rebuilding your life can go on forever and ever. And it if you do it right, it will go on forever and ever. You know, I have to tell you the truth. This morning, when I woke up, I really couldn't wait to come in here and sit. I just couldn't wait. It's just so wonderful to die on the cushion and come back to life. You know, over and over again, it's every time it happens a different way every time. You know, you die a different way every time. You drop the body a different way every time. And for some, you know, for a long time, there are sessions where you don't quite manage to drop the body every time. That's the truth. But we do it, you know, sometimes in a little way and sometimes in a big way. But this dying is great. You know, because I don't know how it's going to be when I lose this body, literally. But I have been practicing dying quite a bit. And I don't think I'm going to be afraid. I really don't. Because it's really not in any way different from, I think, what happens on the cushion. You know, one of the interesting things about Zen is that we don't talk a lot about, like, reincarnation. And the Tibetan tradition is obsessively interested in this subject, if I may say so. And all this talk about bardo state between one life and another, and tulkus, reborn teachers, and all this stuff. And, you know, in Zen too, we have some of the same beliefs, but really, you know, we're all tulkus. You know, we're all dying on the cushion and being reborn all the time. Dropping the literal body isn't going to be, so far as I can guess, any different from what we do on the cushion. You know, if we sit on the cushion, we have pain, we enter shock, we become distanced from our bodies a little bit, or a great deal, depending on how it goes. And then we experience the world in a fresh way. And, you know, sometimes we don't want to die. You know, we don't want to die. And so we have a little trouble being reborn. You know, and sometimes you can be too anxious about it, you know. You can want it too badly. Or you can want to be reborn too badly, you know. You really have to not worry about consequences, even in the least. You just have to die. And you'll be reborn in the form that is being prepared for you by your actions now. You know, this is literally true, but also it's true of meditation practice, you know. There's a one, you know, I forgot to bring that, but there's a wonderful collection of poems, and they're called the Theragata. The Theragata. These are some of the earliest poems written by women in Buddhism. And I brought them to this class I'm teaching. I brought some of them, and they're quite moving. Because they're stories about women who were following the path they've had the Dunkensho experience when they've written a poem called Agatha. And Teri means a teacher. It's a, the masculine is Tera, like in Theravada, and the feminine is Teri. So these are the poems of the teachers. And there's one poem that's so simple, it's so beautiful. It's about a woman. She just says, you know, I had a life that was rich with helping other people, basically. And I practiced meditation, and one day, everything dropped away, and I was liberated. It's so simple. It's just like, you know, I helped a lot. I lived a life of service to others. I was helpful to others. I think it's something like rich with helping others. You know, my life was rich with helping others, and I was practicing the way, and I woke up. So simple, so beautiful. This is like, if only we could all be that simple as that woman. You know, there's other poems which are more complicated. You know, people get tangled up. They're very beautiful. One woman writes about how she started out, she took vows and became a nun. And she said, but you know, I got caught up in getting alms and getting presents. You know, so I would go begging and I would hope for delicious food or cash donation. And I got caught up in sort of like the business of Buddhism. And then I said to myself, hey, get a grip on yourself. You're wasting your life. So I really started meditating and I had my great awakening. See, that's a very human account. And there's another one where a woman says, you know, everybody else is waking up, but I can't seem to wake up. And it, she says that it's like everybody else is like a farmer who's planted a bumper crop. And I sit on my darn cushion and I can't have awakening. So, you know, these are all different people going for the same goal with different attitudes, starting with different attitudes. You know, I was never like that woman who could be so simple. You know, there's people who are just very simple. They have a good heart, they help others, and they wake up. And then there's people who are, you know, more complicated, and they complicate things, and this is part of their learning process. You know, and then there's people who get very complicated, and look at others and feel jealousy, or I was more like that. So you know, but interestingly, all of them wake up, you know. And every session, I think, we wake up a little bit. I think that's really true. Even if we don't, quote-unquote, answer our koan, you know, we die on the cushion a little bit, and we have a little bit of openness. You know, and you may not quite answer the koan in any particular session, or even in a year. But every time you try, you know, and you go into that emptiness, you know, you're preparing to be reborn in a better life, better state. And you'll be reborn as a more compassionate being, kinder, more connected, happier, you know. And so really all we have to do on the cushion right now is just die. And just do it as well as you can. And, you know, new life is being prepared for you right now. It's by life, by the universe itself. So just let it carry you along. Your only responsibility is to empty out on the cushion and call, moo, call, kills a cat, call, hot water, cold water, whatever your koan happens to be. All you have to do is die on the cushion. There's nothing else to it. The rest is beyond your control, right? What will be reborn out of that is beyond your control. It's like a new life coming into the world, like a baby. So we can't really know what the baby's going to look like, but we just know it's going to be a new life. wonderful new life. Whatever it is, the baby's going to always have a family resemblance. It's going to look like Buddha. Definitely. Each time, a little bit more and more like Buddha. Spooky. Always, all becoming Buddhas, absolutely. I mean, I hope that's why you're here. I know that in this life, I will not become Buddha, become a Buddha. But I will give it my best shot and to prepare for my next one. Now, on and on. That's the four great vows, right? That's what we say every time we do sutras. We basically say, it may take an infinite number of lives to become Buddha, but I promise to do it. My ignorance is infinite, but I promise to overcome it. There's an infinite amount of awakening to uncover, and I promise to uncover it. I promise, even though that human ignorance is endless and infinite, I will never stop trying to help other people. All on the road to Buddha. We just take one step at a time, do our best, die on the cushion, and then see what's reborn in the next moment. Moment by moment, this is how we live, right? This is the Zen path. Enlightenment. To talk about enlightenment, to talk about answering your koan, in a certain sense, these are all just like pretty things you show to a baby, to amuse the baby, right? I mean, the real point is to die and be reborn. How we are reborn is beyond our control. It's always going to be a beautiful birth, right? Next moment is a beautiful moment if we're truly dead on the cushion. So we prepare for this rebirth by just dying. Very simple, very beautiful. Don't worry about answering your koan. Don't worry about anything. It's all moving forward in this natural way. Joshu's a newborn baby. Main subject. A monk asks Joshu, does a newborn baby possess the six senses or not? Joshu said it's like throwing a ball into the rapids. The monk later asked Tosu, what is the meaning of throwing a ball into the rapids? Tosu said nen after nen without ceasing. See, each nen is like a moment of consciousness. It's just like a basically, each moment actually has three parts. But in this case, they're just the same. Moment by moment. It's like each moment we're born and we die. Each moment we're born and we die. See, all you have to do is ride that way. Be born and then die. Be born, die. And this is a path of purification, right? It's beautiful. The question, the six senses, purposeless. Well acquainted with it, the masters, a ball is thrown into the rapids. Do you know where it is carried?